Hosea chapter 9, and we've read through this, and this is, I tell you what, as I study, I hope I can communicate what is in these verses, because as I prepare this and put these notes together, I think this is so cutting edge of where we're at. It's almost like you wish you could somehow take and make this some kind of a public proclamation. Everyone's got to listen to this. Not me, necessarily. I mean, that would be somebody better. But some kind of a... Do you understand? This is what was going on in their country. And do you see how these things parallel? And I hope I can communicate that. But nonetheless, here we go. Chapter 9 of Hosea. I'm reading in the NIV. I'll read through the first 9 verses quickly and see what we talked about last week. Chapter 9, verse 1. Do not rejoice, O Israel. Do not be jubilant like the other nations, for you have been unfaithful to your God. You love the wages of a prostitute at every threshing floor. So right there, Israel, the other nations can have their pagan festivals, but Israel, you can't rejoice like that. You've got to stay over here in the law of Moses. And they've gone over like a prostitute and joined with the other gods. Threshing floors and wine presses will not feed the people. The new wine will fail them. This is going to be a result. You're over there worshiping the pagans, trying to get the fertility cults and the agriculture working. It's not going to work. They'll not remain in the Lord's land. Ephraim will return to Egypt and eat unclean food in Assyria. There's going to be a deportation. They're going to be scattered. They will not pour out wine offerings to the Lord. Now, while they're in this place of dispersion, they will not pour out wine offerings to the Lord, nor will they their sacrifices please Him. Such sacrifices will be like the bread of mourners. In other words, you're not even going to have a chance to worship your God. He's putting you in a place, in a situation where you have no temple, you have no altar, you have no priesthood. You can't even operate. And that's where Israel's at today, for example. And you ask them, I've been over there and we talk to them, like at the Western Wall or some of the rabbis that are around, and they'll say, well, you know, how do you get forgiven of your sins? They say, well, even in the New Old Testament, David would confess his sins, that the sacrifices weren't, you know, it was the attitude of the heart. So it's interesting to see them. And if that's a true statement, even Protestants would agree with that. But they've had to, since Jerusalem fell in 70 AD, the Jews have had to worship their God, go through the rituals without actually doing the rituals. And that's being said. All who eat of them will be unclean. This, in other words, if you try to do it, you're doing it wrong. You can't worship God the right way unless you've got the temple. And if you do it, you're making yourself unclean. This food will be for themselves. It will not come to the temple of the Lord. In other words, any food you got is just for yourself. There's no religious significance. What will you do on the day of your appointed feast, on the festival days of the Lord? In other words, when there's a festival day, what are you going to do? I mean, you're not going to do anything. There's nothing you can do. This is a feast day, but we can't feast. This is a fasting day. We can't. There's nothing we can do. There's no celebration. Even if they escape from destruction, Egypt will gather them. So here comes the Assyrians. They're going to escape. Egypt will collect them, and you'll be taken to Memphis, and you'll die in Memphis, one of the burial places. Their treasures of silver will be taken over by briars, and thorns will overrun their tents. In other words, that's the land. It's going to be overrun. Your possessions will be overgrown with thickets, and thorns will overrun your houses. It's just going to be desolate. The days of punishment are coming. The days of reckoning are at hand. Let Israel know this. That's an announcement. Let Israel know this. This is the punishment is now starting. Because your sins are so many and your hostility so great. Oh, and this is kind of where we ended last week. There's been a prophet has been announcing this problem for years. But because their sins are so many and they're so hostile towards the concept that God wants them to know, the prophet is considered a fool, the inspired man, a maniac, or the spiritual man who's speaking by the Spirit, a maniac. The prophet, along with my God, is the watchman over Ephraim, yet snares await him on all his paths and hostility in the house of his God. So you have the prophet. They cannot understand the prophet. They do not understand or hear. Their worldview is so different that when the prophet makes these announcements, this is not right. They're like, that's crazy. That's ridiculous. Like we maybe would say, we've got some Christian values, but you present those, you know, you've done it. You've got Christian values, but to present them to the world, you're a madman. You're crazy. Here's the prophet trying to bring the people back. And so the prophet, along with God, is the watchman. He's not the judge. He's not trying to be judgmental. He's the watchman trying to say, no, don't go there. He's there for your protection. And yet what it says here, what do they do to him? Two things. They set snares for him. Everything he says, they try to trap him in his words. You said this, or it's going to be illegal. We're going to accuse you of this. Or he goes to the house of his God, and at the house of his God, he speaks the word of God at the house of God, and he is met with hostility. So even the very place that God is supposed to be at, the people reject the prophet. So that's how frustrating it is for Amos and Micah and Hosea. They have sunk deep into corruption as in the days of Gibeah, and we read that last week. That is at the bottom, probably the worst chapters in the Bible are the last four chapters of Judges, where just wicked, I mean, the nonsensical, wicked things are happening, and it's like the fourth generation. And they've reached the bottom. In other words, they've sunk deep into corruption. How deep are they into corruption? It's like the days of Gibeah. God will remember their wickedness and punish them for their sins. Now chapter 9, verse 10. I'll read the rest of this. I'll just read it and kind of teach it as I go. When I found Israel, it was like finding grapes in the desert. When I saw your fathers, it was like seeing the early fruit on the fig tree. But when they came to Baal Peor, they consecrated themselves to the shameful idol and became as vile as the thing they loved. So now God is going back, Yahweh is going back to the wilderness. We're going to go back to Sinai. We're going to go back to the wilderness where they're Sinai, the Mount Sinai. And they're in the wilderness like a desert. And it's like finding grapes. You're not going to find grapes in the wilderness, except in a rare case. And if you bump into them, it's like, wow, what a pleasure. What a delight. This was a surprise. Or like new figs, the first figs were a delicacy. You see that in Isaiah and other places. New figs, the fresh figs, the first of the figs, probably because you haven't had fresh figs for so long, and now the fresh figs are there. They're a delicacy. When Yahweh found Israel, and he found them not just with Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and all the time in Egypt, but they became his nation. They are Yahweh's nation. And they became Yahweh's nation at Mount Sinai. And so now they are Yahweh's nation. And he was delighted. He was excited. He was pleased. It was like grapes finding in somewhere you didn't expect. Here they are. Here are my people. And he's excited. But right away, he says, when I saw your fathers, so he's talking to these people in 738, you know, that time period here. But he's talking back around 1440 BC, around there, and you can set the dates as you study it. But I saw your fathers. It was like seeing the early, I was excited about your fathers and what we're going to do. But when they came to Baal Peor, and Baal Peor is this place right here. I've got a map on, there's the Dead Sea, Galilee, Jordan River. The other way. They are camped right here. This is where Israel's camped at. This was a couple mountaintops right here. Peor, this is the Moabites, Moabite territory. And there's a Baal, the Baal of Peor. Now, the Baal, there would be Baals, local gods at these different locations. And so Baal is not just generally just any, you know, this one universal god. They would adapt the Baals to their location. He would be the Baal of Peor. They would be the Baal of Samaria. When they came to Baal Peor, they consecrated themselves to that shameful idol. And what they did, and you know the story. In fact, if you turn the page, it's Numbers 25, verses 1 through 18. It'd be interesting to read that. Notice the word Baal is the word shame, is boset, the shame of Peor. And it's going to come out later on in this verse. They're going to worship the shame of Peor, and they're going to become like the god they worship. They became shameful. They're like the grapes, the figs. God was very excited. But because they worshiped something else, they themselves became that shameful image. And you know the story. If you turn the page, I think I've got a map there. There's a little thing I've tried to scribble on the board. And you know the story. We referred to it last night in our eschatology class, going up by the Euphrates River. There's a prophet there named Balaam. And Balak is the king down here. And he sees Israel. Israel has gone by them. Israel's target is here. Israel's not even going to mess with the Moabites. Not even concerned about them. They've gone around them. That was given to them. But Balak isn't sure. He's concerned that something's going to happen. So he sends for this famous prophet, Balaam, who is a prophet of Yahweh. He's a prophet of the Lord. We saw that last night in Numbers. We had five oracles, and every one of them was right on track. He comes down, and he's supposed to curse these people. He's supposed to stand on these mountains and curse the Israelites. And ends up, he can't curse them because he is speaking by the Lord. And he says, how can you curse those whom the Lord has blessed? I can't do this thing. I can only speak. My eye sees clearly, and these people are blessed. May my death be like their death. If I'm going to die, I want to die like these people. They're blessed of God. And Balak was so upset. He told him, I could have made you rich. I could have made you rich. And that's kind of the end of the story. He goes back away, and Balak was mad at Balaam. Except there's a couple of verses, and I've got that right here. If you look on page 9, it's actually second page. It's Balaam could not curse, point 4. Do I have the... Oh, yeah, right there at the bottom of the map. No, that's not it. Right, he could not, but where does it say there's a definite... So Balaam took Balaam and that one? Oh, my gosh. Yeah, no, where Balaam is going to... I thought I put the verse in there. It's in Numbers or Deuteronomy. Numbers 31, 6.4. Is that the one you're talking about? You keep saying it and I keep missing it. Balaam could not curse Israel, but he did make the suggestions to seduce the men into idol worship. That's what you're talking about. It's in Numbers 31, 16, and it's very clear. Even in the book of 2 Peter and Jude, Balaam is brought up as an example of the corrupt teachers in the church that sell themselves out for money, the sin of Balaam. And he got paid not for cursing him, but for giving Balak the idea that you've got to get these people to sin. If they'll violate their covenant with their God, see how much Balaam knows a lot. He knows a lot about the spiritual world, he knows Yahweh, and he knows what's going on with Israel. And he realizes they've entered into a covenant with Yahweh that if they're going to get in trouble, they're going to have to violate that covenant. So he says, you take your women and you seduce them in and get them to do two things. It's going to be sexual immorality, and they're going to have to consecrate themselves to worship your Baal with some meat. So you're going to have to get the meat, you're going to have to sacrifice some meat. In other words, you understand what I'm saying here. And the men went for that. And a plague broke out among the Israelites, and God, they began to worship Baal Peor. And once again, it's a sexual sin, very similar to what's taking place in Israel up here in Israel, in northern Israel at that time. One more point about that verse, when you look at the notes right there, is that the word for the early fruit was also connected to words such as for the firstborn child, which ties into, and I've got the reference there, that when he's saying you're like the first figs of the season, Israel was the first born or the first son, and the main thing there was first son, the early figs, he was the one that was going to have the inheritance rights. All of Yahweh's blessings were going to come first to Israel, and then, of course, go to the rest of the world. So that's their position in the beginning. That's what Hosea is saying there. And as it ends right there, became as vile as the thing they loved, and they're now shameful. Verse 11, Ephraim's glory will fly away like a bird, and the glory of Ephraim is Yahweh, and not their ancient behavior, but even their current behavior, that glory is going to leave. Now, just like Ezekiel, I've got the notes there on page. I have that written down there somewhere. In Ezekiel, is it Ezekiel chapter 11, where you see the cherubim bring the chariot of God to the front of the temple, and then it goes away. It flies, the glory leaves the temple. And what ends up happening is then they start marking people that are believers, and those that aren't believers, the angels go out and begin slaughtering. So the glory in Ezekiel leaves the temple. This is going to come later with Judah. But here, the glory is going to fly away. God's glory is going to leave. Ephraim's glory will fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. In the page 9 of the notes in the English Standard, same thing, Ephraim's glory shall fly away. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. Israel will begin to see the population declining. And this is our first talk about children in these last chapters. It's going to get kind of sad about children, but it's going to begin a population. Their glory is gone, and so there's going to be a time period of just continuous decline as they continue with this shame. And the shame is going to be the false ideas, the false philosophy, false world's view, and they're going to begin pursuing them, but it's going to lead to zero production. There's going to be, as it says right here, and this is written, as you can see in the notes, in staccato in the Hebrew. One of the commentators says it's like a burst of emotional, just staccato talking in verses 11 and 12. There's going to be no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. And in verse 12, even if they bring up children, I will bereave them till none is left. In other words, this is a double whammy right here. And this is important. This is important to understand. There's several things I'd really like to draw out of this tonight, and this would be the first one. One, if you've got a false world view, it's not going to work. In fact, as I've said this before, I just listened to, on the way over, Tony listened to one of those podcasts, Knowles and, what's the senator's name? You know who I'm talking about? Ted Cruz. Thank you, dear. And anyway, they were saying the very same thing, that when as a conservative, you know, all hope is lost. You've lost the media, you've lost the Hollywood, you've lost the schools, the university, everybody's... But they say the thing is that if there's any hope, you always got the eternal hope, but what's your hope in this age right here? And this is what they were saying, and this is something I've tried to point out before too, but it's fun to hear them say it, is we have reality. I mean, you can rebel against truth and reality and have a false worldview and take the whole culture down, but it will only last for so long because you haven't changed reality. You haven't changed truth. That's why these false ideologies, they burn out. They're like a shooting star. They can't sustain. That's why America's been so great, because we've been in tune with reality, following, you know, Christian principles, following science. But as you abandon Christian principles, as you abandon science, as you rewrite history, you're going into this world that doesn't exist. And it's going to feel good for a while, just like jumping off a tall building. You say, I'm flying, look at I'm flying. But you're not flying, you're falling, and eventually you hit reality. It's called concrete. And here, these people, they've left the glory, which you could say that's truth, that's reality, and they've gone after these shameful ideologies. And so they're going to have this. Watch. It says right here, no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. I mean, you're not going to produce. Nothing's going to happen. Even though you've got all this fertility stuff going on as far as this immoral sexuality, you're not going to produce anything in life. You're worshiping the gods of fertility, but no one's getting pregnant. No one's going to conceive. No one's going to have a child. And then the second thing is in verse 12. Even if they bring up, even if in this false reality, something works. You have a child. Even if in this false worldview you produce something of value, Yahweh says, even if they bring up children, I will bereave them till none is left. Woe to them when I depart from them. In other words, your false reality is going to produce zero, nothing. And then Yahweh says, but if you do, I'll make sure I destroy it. Meaning, you're going to lose in time, and if somehow you slip some kind of production, I'm going to come out and destroy it. In other words, they're fighting reality, and they're fighting the creator of reality. And then he says, woe to them when I depart from them. And that is a serious thing to think about. Because when you start seeing people, like you say, you look at our culture, and we're losing stuff. We're losing academics. We're losing the media. We're losing, you know, common sense. We're losing the work ethic. Oh, whatever. You're losing these things. It's like, it's not going to last. People are going to come back. You're going to have to work. You're going to have to be productive. You're going to have to support families. You've got to have marriage. You can't have for a while, as you're falling from the top story down to the concrete. Look, we've got a society with no family. We have no marriage. We don't have to work. Everything's free. Yeah, exactly. And I'm flying as I jump off the top of the building. But reality's going to catch up. That's verse 12. And talking about children here, God promises, he says, I will destroy. And that children, that's going to be an actual the next generation, the children are going to have to endure what their parents have created. If you want to feel sorry for somebody, feel sorry for the children, because their parents are doing stupid things with our culture, with our government, with our education, and the children are going to grow into this, and they're going to reap the whirlwind that their parents have sown, if we're not already reaping the whirlwind that our parents sowed. And in Luke 23:28, in 30 AD, Jerusalem was in the same situation. In 70 AD, it was going to fall. The temple would be destroyed 40 years. Luke 23:28 on page 10.2, Jesus says he was carrying his cross. And you know this verse, but it's exactly, so many times you see the things repeated in the prophets, and then Jesus says something, if it's not exactly the same, it's very similar. Many of the things Jesus said on the Temple Mount were a mere rehashing, a restating of what Jeremiah said on the Temple Mount. As he's carrying his cross, there was women that were crying for him. And he didn't stop and thank them. Jesus says the same thing I write. He says, "Daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children." And what he was talking, because if people do this while the tree is green, you know this story, I don't want to bore you. The tree is green. What will they do when the tree is dry? And this is the same thing. We're going to get into dry roots here in these verses already. In 30 AD, if I were to make a connection to our culture, this is all, I'm going to say it, it's on video, it's on the record, but this is not biblical. This is just my take. Is in, say, 2000, and this is 2040 in our culture. In 2000, we were still green. God was still working in our culture. There were still things. In 30 AD, God is still working in Israel, in Jerusalem. The Messiah is there. They just did enormous amounts of miracles. People are coming to the Christ. He's making himself very evident. He's talking. He's teaching on the Temple Mount. It's still green. Now, what is dark is the fact that the people's hearts are rejecting it. Well, that's kind of where we were, let's say, in 2000, if I'm using my illustration here. God is still working. And Jesus is being crucified in 30 AD, and women are crying. He says, if people will do this, what will they do? They will kill an innocent man. They will crucify the prophet. I mean, I know he's the Son of God, but he's like Hosea. He was considered a madman. They couldn't see him. They put thorns and thistles and snaps and snares wherever he was, try to capture him. And when he went to the house of the Lord, what was he met with? Hostility, just like Hosea, just like a prophet. So it's green. God is still working and trying to bring life out of the plant production, but there's going to come a time when he's going to cut the tree down, and the tree is going to be dead, dry. He says, if this is what's happening when it's still green, when the prophet is still speaking, what is it going to be like when the tree is cut down? Don't cry for me. Cry for your children and yourselves. Because if these children were 5 years old in 30 AD, they're 40 and 45 years old as the Jewish wars are being fought, talking 65 to 70 AD. And yourselves, if you're a 20-year-old mother, add 40 years to it, you're a 60-year-old or 65-year-old grandmother. Cry. Don't cry for me. Don't cry in 2000. Don't cry when we still are preaching and teaching. Cry for 40 years from now when this, he says, if this is what's happening when it's green, what's it going to be like when God has flown away? And that's what this is exactly about, when the glory is gone. Deuteronomy 32:25 says the children would die outdoors. The sore shall be rave. The indoors tear for young man and woman alike, the nursing child and with the man with gray hairs. The children are not going to be spared. And so that's it. Chapter 9, verse 13. Ephraim, as I have seen, was like a young palm planted in a meadow, but Ephraim must lead his children out to slaughter. Now, again, we're not done with children. We're talking about children. We're talking about the next generation. And the point of this children is this, is if you have trouble, if you have a tough life, if you're living through the depression, But you have children, they've got a brighter future. The American dream is still there. You can live through trouble, but guess what? You made a better world for your children. Or if you've got a productive society, a society that is, you know, scientific, it's moral, and you build a society, we're going to talk about this coming up, you're going to be able to hand that off to your children, and you took and made a society or added, your children are going to have to make it greater. They're going to be able to make it better. They're going to take your scientific, your industrial advances, your technology advances, and take it to the next level. And again, we, being evolutionists, secularists, we think that is just human progress. Human progress is just like this. We just keep it. Why is our generation or this generation and their technology ahead of the 70s technology? Because of evolution. And why did we have, you know, greater technology in the 60s than we did in the 20s and the 1880s? Why, you understand, because we're just getting better and better. That's a false concept. Because, you know the book, The 5,000 Year Leap? You know the book, 5,000 Year Leap? Anybody saw The 5,000 Year Leap? You know that book? Hey, real quick, this is similar, but it's off subject, so I don't want to waste time on this. The idea of the book is you go back from, say, I think it was written in the 80s, I think, but you go back 200 years, you know, 1980, 1880, 1780, and the way the world was in 1780 was basically the way it was in 6,000 BC. Do you understand? Okay, they had rifles, they had gunpowder, but they still, you know, rode horses, they still had ovens, I mean, not ovens, but they had fireplaces in their houses. There wasn't much change. And then the last 200 years, things have just shot off the charts. You've gone from plowing with a horse and a metal plow like they did 6,000 years ago to going into outer space in 200 years. And what happened in the last 200 years? Well, you know, we discovered new material. We went to the moon and found electricity. It's like everything that we've used in the last 200 years has always been here. They could have done what we did in 1960 in the year 5000. And it was all there. I mean, you know, they built math and calculus and all but the concepts. But it, like, nothing changed except, they say in this book, 28 basic principles of freedom. And it was part of our culture. And it just let loose the potential of mankind because we were not dominated by false worldviews. They did it. They created a culture based on, this would be a book, I mean, the liberals, they would burn this, they would burn the school down before they let a kid read this book. If you made this mandatory reading in all high schools, I can almost guarantee, I don't know, but if you would have riots. You would have stinking riots. But if you could make everybody read this and understand this, you could turn our culture around in 12 months, if they would understand that the reason we have what we have is because of the values, the principles that we have unleashed, starting with the American experiment, the concept here. And again, that's the principle. There are 5,000 years of little progress, and all of a sudden 200 years, how come? Evolution's true. That has nothing to do with, because we have seen cultures go up and cultures go down. I tell the kids, we talk about technology in school. And I make this point, you know, the book starts off, I have a technology book. The first page has got a caveman, you know, with some kind of animal skins and then a rock. And he's, you know, carving a stick with a rock or something. That's technology. And now we're way up here. I says, you know, there's still cavemen in the world today? And the reaction is like, no. And I say, there is. I mean, there are people that are living like this in the world. They don't have the technology we've got. I say, you understand, if you lose your technology, if electricity goes off, if there's a snowstorm, and it was interesting because sometime in January or February, I was talking to the class, and they could not wrap their mind. I says, you do understand, and it's amazing, within a matter of about 4 weeks, it was like reality. I says, you do understand that if for some reason the interstate system is interrupted, if there's a snowstorm, if somehow it gets bombed, if there's some, you know, we run out of gasoline, I mean, where are you going to get your food? I mean, and again, you know, there's like
the grocery store. I mean, they don't, I mean, you, we don't, I mean, I fall into the trap. It's like the grocery store. It's like, you understand, that is constantly, and we got a taste of it in March and April, of the supply chain. And how far are we away from, I tell them, listen, we're this close. We're one national disaster. If someone could shut off the electricity or shut off our power grid, we're going to wish we lived in a cave and knew how to start a fire. Because my house in West Des Moines, made out of sheetrock and siding, it's warm and cool. Cool in summer, warm, because I've got a furnace and insulation. But soon as I run out of power, that thing freezes up, the pipes break, I've got no water, I've got no... I'm going to tear my house down, burn it for fuel. I mean, it's nothing. You're going to wish you had a cave that you could hide in. We're like 30 days away from being cavemen. It's like, well, you read the book of Revelation. Where do they end up? I mean, in Revelation, they end up back in that situation. The world is not going like evolution, getting better and better socially, culturally. It's up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. You follow God, you follow reality, you're up here. You rebel against reality, you're down here until you figure out, and that's what they're saying on this show, for example, is truth is always going to win. You may go here, this culture may take us to the depths of human depravity, but reality is still there. And we're going to have to figure out how to work. We're going to have to figure out how to communicate, how to function, how to have a family, how to take care of children, and we'll eventually start to find these ways back. This cycle's been going on for as long as Adam's been on the earth. Remember, Adam was not put in a cave. He's put in a garden. Adam started up here and fell here. Adam was not the first caveman. That is a crazy concept. Okay. God made him clothes. I mean, I'm way off subject. They took like fig leaves or something and covered themselves with leaves, and God took animal skin and made clothes. Okay, now you've never heard this before. I've never even said this before. So I'm about into heresy. But the God who created the universe sees the naked man and woman and sees they put some leaves on. So he makes them clothes out of animal skin. So what we end up with is some kind of caveman patch, you know. The woman's got a two-piece, the man's got some kind of little, you know, skirt on. The creator of the universe, who designed everything, and you should saw what he did with the high priest garments. Whenever the angels or Jesus shows up, Jesus went to the cross and didn't tear his clothes, they wanted to gamble for him because this is really nice. He had nice stuff. Don't you think Adam, coming out of the garden, and Eve came out, they weren't just dressed like cave people. I mean, they didn't make their clothes. The creator of the universe made their clothes. I'm just thinking about it. I mean, it's not going to be like, well, here's a pair of shorts and here's a two-piece, put that on. It's like, it's got to be better. That's an assumption. Okay, but that we're right. We're still on target here. Don't be disheartened. Chapter 9, verse 12. Even if they bring up children, I will bereave them till none is left. Woe to them when I depart. Chapter 9, verse 13. Ephraim, as I have seen, was like a young palm planted in a meadow. Now, there's two positions here. One, this was reality. They were like a young palm. That's the translation. It is the same word. It's also the word like rock. It can also refer to tire. If you look, and again, I'll just throw this out there. They're like a young palm, and it says planted in a meadow. Some say, translations say, transplanted in a meadow. Now, this is true. This is real. They were in northern Israel. You've got the maps. You've got, again, here's Dead Sea, Jordan, Galilee up here. Here's the Megiddo Valley right here. Here's the coast. At this time, Jezreel and Samaria, they're up in this area. They're right on the coast of Megiddo, Jezreel, on this fertile valley. The best farmland, the best land in Israel is Israel. Everybody wants this. We know that the trade route ran here. The trade route ran through there. The trade route ran down the coastal plain.
And that's why Jeroboam was so prosperous, because they had all this money. We know these things. So they were planted. They could travel to the north, or they could trade to the north to the south, from where Turkey is, Anatolia, down to Egypt, from Euphrates, Mesopotamia, Arabia, even to the coast. And that's why Tyre is interesting, because Tyre is right up here on the coast. And if you read it another way, Tyre, they were like Tyre planted by a meadow. And Tyre, the Phoenicians, as you know, they're the seafaring people. They're the ones that started all those cities called Tarshish. Tarshish. Now, Tarshish is probably not one location. Tarshish is like, it means port city or Portland, like Portland. It's coastal. It's the name of a city on the coast. And if you go through, in Jonah, I showed you the map. I made a map. There's like 12 different Tarshishes around, because basically it means coastal city. And the Phoenicians started all those for trade reasons. And they may have gone out up the Atlantic coast. They've gone down the African coast. People keep trying to find out if they've made it all the way to the Americas. And there's any kind of proof they've had of that, it's always been proven fraudulent. But nonetheless, Tyre completely traded to the west. Israel, in reality, I'll read it again. Ephraim, as I have seen, God says, was like a young plant, a young palm planted in a meadow. Or you could say, if you want to change the word from palm, like you go to the interlinear on the next page, you can see the word Tyre right there. In the first line of the interlinear, Ephraim, just as I saw like Tyre, planted in a pleasant place. So either he's saying they're a palm planted in a pleasant meadow, or they're planted in a place just like Tyre was. And in my point, either way, the reality was Israel should have taken their culture from this level and just shot off the charts. Economically, academically, discovery, influence. Listen, Tarshish or Tyre had cities all across the Mediterranean. They were colonizing the Mediterranean, if not the African and European coast. They had taken their culture and spread it, the people of Tyre, because they learned to use the ships. Israel, right here, was in that position. They had access to the eastern world. They had access to the southern world. They had access to the north, and they had access to the west. They were like Tyre in the meadow. Nothing can stop you. Or they're like a palm in a meadow, if you want either translation. Tyre's a great illustration. That's the reality. Now watch this. But Ephraim must lead his children out to slaughter. In other words, you were here as a culture, and I put you at a place where you could expand and hand off to your children a growing, expanding society, a culture that was the envy of the world. But instead, because you've accepted a false reality, you will not hand a culture to your children that's growing, an economy that's booming, that's changing the world. Instead, you're going to lead your children to slaughter. You're going to hand your children a culture, a society that is basically taking them by the hand and taking them out to the executioner or the murderer. And there you can see the word right there. If you turn the page. And this, if we want to say something to our culture, this would be a great thing to preach, teach our culture. Point three on page 11. Instead of their children inheriting the parents' rich history, remember that, rich history, and productive economic system, the children would be led by their parents to slaughter. Literally. So Ephraim will bring out to the murderer his children. Or Ephraim will bring his children out to the slayer, the executioner. It's either executioner or murderer. What you have done with your philosophy, with your view of reality, by worshiping what is shameful, you have created a culture which is basically taking your children and handing them over to a murderer. Or taking your children and bringing them to the executioner. Instead of handing them off, and the next generation is going to become greater and the American dream continues to grow, you're going to bury your children. You're destroying your own children. That's exactly what is being said. The point four I wrote down, the contrast is obvious. Instead of parents providing a rich cultural heritage for their children to continue developing, the parents will lead their children to a slaughter that ends their culture. They're ending the culture. You understand? When the children inherit your culture and they make it greater, there's going to be a third and a fourth generation. But if you lead your children to the executioner, your culture's done. I mean, if you kill your children, there's no third generation. It's done. And so they are ending their culture because of your decisions today. You're ending your culture. And I would say to America, that's what you are doing. You, if you come out of the 1880s, 1920s, 1960s, people talk about the American dream. You know, the kids are doing better. Everything's getting better because we were building on some principles. And people have been chipping away at it, chipping away, trying to change our philosophy. And they've arrived. We've sown to the wind. We're reaping the whirlwind. And we are at this place right now where this is the fourth generation. And it is their fourth generation. It was Jesus' generation heading into the fourth generation. And are we there today? Do you think we're rewriting? Well, here. You think we're discovering some new things and changing our history? And all of our founding fathers and everything we ever did was evil. They're all villains of history. Jesus Christ and all of Christianity was nothing but oppression. And we're going to shake all that off, and we're going to find a better America tomorrow. Do you think that's what's going to happen? I mean, somebody does. Again, we're not talking about America, we're talking about Israel. Chapter 9, verse 14, give them, O Lord, what will you give? And this is a frustration. This is probably a state of frustration. In fact, you got there, point 2 on page 12. This is either bitterness or sarcasm of Hosea speaking to Yahweh in frustration for Israel refusing to hear his words of advice. So this is now Hosea speaking. And you hear what he says? Give them, O Lord, what will you give them? Give them a miscarrying womb and dry breast. In other words, nothing productive. Those were I could go and develop that in the fertility cults, the womb and the breast. When you see those little figurines of the fertility goddess, they've always got like large breasts and they've got a definite indication of the womb. Those weren't like pornography. Those weren't like, you know, some, they would be maybe immoral in the fertility cults in their ideology, but they were worshiping the gods that produced, you know, the breasts that could feed the children and wombs that would produce and keep the generation. That what that was about. Anyway, he's reversing that. Give them, O Lord, what will you give them? And that's what this says right here. Chapter 9, verse 15. Every evil of theirs is in Gilgal. There we go. Now this, you know, you always want, here's one of those things. Am I just on a rampage? Am I just like getting all off the subject? Maybe. But when you get a verse like this, you realize, oh my gosh, I might be nailing it. Gilgal. This is where it all began. For every evil of theirs is in Gilgal. There I began to hate them. That's important. Because of the wickedness of their deeds, I will drive them out of my house. That's the language of divorce right there. I will love them no more. All their princes are rebels. Now, what we need to do is turn this page and Gilgal. You know Gilgal, Dead Sea, Jordan, Galilee, Jericho. Here's the place where the Israelites camped, Shittim right across here. Where that's the ruins of Sodom right there. They've been buried for centuries, been dead for centuries. They camped on that site because it's a high place. You can still see it. They crossed the Jordan, and they camped at Gilgal. And you know what happened at Gilgal? When the priest stepped in the water at the Jordan, it stopped flowing up here at a place called Adam, and it went dry, and all the people went across as the priest stood on a platform, maybe a platform, made out of 12 stones. Again, this you can read it when we went through Joshua. You see that the men of Israel, one from each tribe, was supposed to take a stone and take it out of the Jordan. Potentially, what they did, they took those 12 stones and stood them around and made a platform for the priests to stand on with the ark as the people went by. And then after the ark went out, those 12 men picked up those 12 stones. Either if they just took them off the bottom and took them up on shore, or they made a platform and then took them up on shore, you got to decide. But they took those 12 stones and they put them in a circle at Gilgal. It means the place of the circle. Why did they do that? Right out of Joshua. Now watch this. I'm talking about you've got to have truth. You've got to have reality. And you've got to know history. If you change reality, you've got a false reality. If you forget history, if it's good or if it's bad,
If you forget history, you're going to screw up. We need to identify mistakes that Nebuchadnezzar made, the great things Nebuchadnezzar did. We need to go through what was the great things the Romans did. What were the mistakes the Romans made? We got to go through, you know, my father's life. What were the great things my dad did? What are some things I'm going to avoid? My boys do this. These are some things my dad did. Galen was a good dad. He did these things. But then they sit around on the deck with me and we talk. It's like, yeah, but dad, remember, it's like, I know, I'm sorry about that. They talk about bad things I did. That's history. It's nice. I don't want my boys to forget their history because when they look back at my life, they realize, Dad, you did some pretty good things. And we could list the things that I did. But we were there, Dad, when you did these things. Yeah, I know. Can you make it better, sons? And I know my sons are trying. They recognize those things. And it's like, we've talked. I see them. We FaceTime. We talk. They're with their children. And it's kind of like, you're going out of your way not to do what I did. And it's like, keep going. You know, or sometimes I say, I wish you'd do more like I did. But nonetheless, you understand what I'm saying. It's good and bad. But you forget history, you forget reality, you're going to have a problem. But reality will always catch back up. History's happened. Now, they set those stones up, top of page 13, number point one. Gilgal was originally a memorial place for the fathers to teach their children the national history and their national religion. They were to teach, this is our history, and this is our religion. And this, in fact, this is what Joshua 4, 5, you can read right in chapter 4, these are the verses. This is what it says. Each of you is to take up a stone on his shoulder according to the number of tribes of Israelites, to serve as a sign among you in the future. Now watch this. In the future, when your children ask you, what do these stones mean? Now why would the children ask, what do those stones in Gilgal mean? Now remember, they didn't have like photographs and in the internet or television. They didn't have tour guides. That would mean these people from Israel, the intention was they'd go back here. This was supposed to be some kind of visitation. This would be some kind of pilgrimage back here. We're going to go back here. And when the kids get back there, when they come every year, and they say, Dad, why do we come back to these stones? There's some kind of pilgrimage to take place. I'm not just going to stack them up and don't forget they're here. They would be honored. They were still there in Hosea's day. They're still there in 738. But things have changed. Anyway, what do these stones mean? Tell them that the flow of the Jordan was cut off before the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord. Joshua, then, at the end of the chapter, says, Joshua set up at Gilgal the 12 stones they had taken out of the Jordan. Now, do not think he just piled them up somewhere there. That's what God told him to do. He set them up, and it became a shrine. It became a place. It became a place of pilgrimage. There's probably, you know, places to stay, or there's places to you know, worship. There's something there. He didn't just set up a pile of 12 stones. He walked through the field one day and said, what do these 12 stones mean? Or, you know, it was a shrine. It was like Shiloh, no doubt. He said to the Israelites, in the future, when your descendants ask their parents, now we're not talking about your children, we're talking about your descendants' children. We're talking about 10 generations from now. Ask their parents, what do these stones mean? Why do we come to this place every year? Or whenever they came, tell them, Israel crossed the Jordan on dry ground. The Lord your God, on dry ground, for the Lord your God dried up the Jordan before you until you had crossed. The Lord your God did to the Jordan what he had done to the Red Sea when he dried it up before us until, now that takes them back from the Jordan, takes them all the way back to the Passover, the Red Sea, the crossing of the Red Sea. He did this so that all the peoples of the earth might know that the hand of the Lord is powerful and so that you might always fear the Lord your God. He did this. He brought us to this land because we are to be a light to the world. And they're placed in a very good place. The coastal plain, the travel routes, the Mediterranean Sea, the whole world is at their fingertips. And never forget what reality is, what our history is, what our God is. Now, that's where Gilgal started off good. But page 12, chapter 9, verse 15, every evil of theirs is in Gilgal. Now this is 738 or whenever, right around this time period. There I began to hate them. At the very place, they're to come back and remember the covenant. And again, the covenant, love, faithful, loving kindness, or loving kindness is faithful covenant love. Don't think emotion. Do not go emotional. God has a covenant. There he loves them. Jacob I've loved, Esau I've hated. Doesn't mean, oh, I'm just infatuated with Jacob, but Esau, I just never liked the guy. No, that's not it at all. I've got a covenant love.
Hate would be the opposite of covenant love. These are marriage terms. You love your wife. It'd be nice if you loved your wife and you had feelings for your wife, but this means you've got a marriage contract. You're married to your wife. You have a contract. Are you loving your wife? Yes, I am faithful to my wife. You don't seem like you're captivated by her love. That's the book of Song of Solomon and Proverbs. You know that. That's another whole story. But that's covenant faith. To hate your wife, this is what you can see. I got it written down here. You'd say if a man hates his wife, it was in the law of Moses, you could give her a certificate of divorce and then drive her away. Send her out of the house. So these are terms of this word drive away, and we're going to see it. It's a drive away. It's a reference to family relations, not military. You don't drive. This is not the word you use to drive the enemy out of the land. It's what you use to drive a family member out of the house because you hate them. You've broken covenant. They've broken covenant. We no longer have a loving contract, a covenant that is not broken. We've broken covenant. I'm driving you away. Now that's important. Well, what about divorce marriage? That's another conversation. We're talking about what is taking place here. God set this up for them to remember his covenant, remember him, tell their children, don't forget this. But now in 738, 740, every evil of theirs is in Gilgal. This place has been corrupted. There I began to hate them. There I began to break my covenant with them. You know, not break it, but they broke with me, and I began to leave. The covenant began to expire. Because of the wickedness of their deeds, I will drive them from my house. Now, when it says house, we're talking about the temple. Don't even worry about what house he's talking about. That's divorce language. They've broken covenant. Our covenant is no good. I'm now in a relationship of hate with no covenant. I'm driving them from my house. I will love them no more. I'll have a faithful covenant no more. All their princes are rebels. Now, if you turn the page there, going back to the very bottom, all their princes are rebels. Point four, leadership is in rebellion to Yahweh. Princes can also refer to officials. It's the same two words, rebellious officials or rebellious princes, used by Isaiah in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 23. Isaiah starts right off on Judah with this. Your princes are rebels, he says. Now here, what does it mean when it says your princes are rebels? Okay, what has taken place here in Gilgal is they've turned this into a Baal shrine. There's all kinds of false religion. They're no longer teaching their history there. Their history has been rewritten. Go to point two. They rewrote their history in 930 B.C. when Jeroboam I leaves the kingdom of Judah. They leave and they go up here, and he sets up the golden calf in Bethel, the golden calf in Dan. I mean, very blatantly changes their God and their religion and changes their history. Do not think it's sad, and I've failed. Because I've watched it happen. I've watched the wind be planted for 40 years as an educator. And just thought, you shouldn't do that. That's not right. You shouldn't do that. But I've watched it, and now the whirlwind is here. And now all I can do is rail against it. But we've been misteaching history in public schools, in universities, since I was in college. It became cool. You were like the one who had insight. If you could somehow find fault with anyone of the past. I mean, it's blatant today. You were like the one. It'd be like coming to a Bible study. And I'm on the flip side of this. I was in Bible studies that the smart people would explain to you why the book of Hosea wasn't written by Hosea. It was fabricated, and they could find, it's called higher textual criticism. They could find certain things in here that, you know, this word wasn't even in use in 738 B.C. It clearly came from the Persian period. And they'd say, oh, that guy is, because you had people that were teaching the Bible blindly, they thought, and then the academics got in and began to teach it very critically and destroyed it. And that's where I come in. That's where I grew up, 60s and 70s, with the Bible just being shredded. It's like, well, what's left? It's like, well, you just got to believe what's in your heart. It's like, because this is all just, man just made this up, fallen man. And look, any of the women, they're not even in here. All the books written by women, they took them out. They hate women. Oh, yeah, that's true. I notice that now. Really, where's the women's books? There's none. That's because the men wrote it. They made it up. Oh, I hate those guys. Me too. It's like, but we got to be good Christians. Yeah, without a Bible, let's do it. Well, then I come in, and it's like, I start reading this, I begin to realize this is what began to change my life. And I began to teach it now as if it's history, as if it's true. I believe it's true. I can prove it's true, I think. The same thing happened historically, or with history. They began, the great scholars, the good teachers, the ones that could look at the founding fathers and find faults with them. Just like my sons can find faults with me, which means what? I can find faults with my dad, which means what? I can find, it's like, we're human. That's not the point. The point is to know history and know what's going on. And this is what's taking place right here. I've got to wrap this up. Jeroboam, point two. So the king took counsel and made two calves of gold, and he said to the people, you have gone up to Jerusalem too long. Notice it says, he took counsel. He took counsel. Jeroboam says, what are we going to do? Because we're going to start our own kingdom. We've got a 500-year history of this place in Jerusalem, of the temple and all these things here. What are we going to do? It takes counsel. They said, well, what we're going to do, it only takes one generation to rewrite our history. You're going to have to set up some very impressive places. You're going to have to make them convenient. Put one right here on the border so it's like they don't have to cross over. Put one up here so they don't think they've got it. Make it easy. Make it adapt to the culture that we're already being infested with. You know, they're always dealing with the Canaanite culture. Adapt it to this culture so we fit in. And tell them, and you're just going to have to sell it. You're just going to have to get on the talk shows and sell it. You're going to have to get the media, get the priesthood. He created his own priesthood. The priesthood was the media. They're the communicators. They're the ones supposed to be teaching the people. The Levites and the priests were the media. He creates his own media, his own priesthood. And this is the theme. You have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Behold, your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. Now again, I'm sure the message was longer than that. That caption. Your new gods, your new history. And then they had to fill in all the blanks. It sold so well, as you know, up until the time of these last kings, it's still saying, but they never repented of the sin of Jeroboam. They never came back to Gilgal, what it was intended for. Turning this up right here. Ephraim is stricken, their root is dried up, they shall bear no fruit, even though they give birth. I'll put their beloved children to death. There you have the same thing there, you know. I mean, you can try. And then here's the chapter 9, verse 17. It's just a summary. If you didn't understand what Hosea was saying in those verses, in all those words, chapter 9, verse 17. My God will reject them. Notice, my God. Hosea, Yahweh is still there. He's still in tune with Yahweh, but these people are not. My God will reject them. Why? Because they have not listened to him. Result, they'll be wanderers among the nations. That's it. I mean, there, I could have done that in 4 minutes. If you look down here, point three, it's interesting. They'll be wanderers among nations. This set in 722. They've got about, you know, if this is 738, 722 is going to set in, and they became wanderers in the nation. Their children and things are dying during this whole period, the slaughter, the murders, and this ends their culture. And everybody goes into captivity or dispersion. Do not, point three there, I say, do not confuse this with the Babylonian captivity. That had a time stamp on it, 70 years. You'll be in Babylon 70 years, and then you'll come back. This captivity that happened in said dispersion has never ended. They've been wandering in the nations ever since this time. Babylon, they went, they came back. And then 70 AD, Jerusalem was destroyed and Israel was scattered again. And they've been scattered. Maybe they came back in 1948. That is still not the return from the Assyrian dispersion. They have never recovered. That is yet an eschatological event. What takes place, to keep your eschatology straight, you have to consider all the things, you know, Babylon, Rome, destruction, but 722, they've been dispersed, and they're going to stay dispersed until they're brought back in the final days. Anyway, that's what's being said there. I think it's pertinent. I kind of wish I could present that better, and you know, but anyway, I was studying this afternoon, and it's like, you know, very serious, and it seems clear, and I wish we could do something. You know, with our culture, you know, teach history and explain. I'll quit. I'll pray and you're free to go. Father, do thank you again for the chance to look into these things. We thank you for your truth and your word. We do ask that we would be humble servants of yours, that we'd be able to speak truth, live truth. We'd be able to stay in reality and be able to explain things to people. And we ask for your mercy, your grace, that yet our tree might still be green as a nation, that you may still
spare us. And Father, we ask that we would see revival in our own times, that maybe the situations we find ourselves in will shock us enough that we will turn back to basics of reality and truth and of your grace, Father. We do again thank you for this opportunity to ask that you would empower all of us to become the people you've called us to be at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Thank you for your patience.